Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Now it's mag time at Monocle. The July-August issue has just hit newsstands, shop shelves and doormats all over the world. And we're here today to tempt and guide you in and around its culture pages. The theme, as regular readers will know, is quality of life. And it's a hit of summer, skin, ice creams and amusing nights out. At least it is on the culture desk. Summer is here and there's no place that better screams British summer than Cornwall, which is where I'll be making my first stop in an attempt to learn the art of painting at the Newlyn Art School. Then we'll be kicking back with Sarah Cracknell, lead singer of Saint-Étienne, amusing on the places of her childhood, which have become the subject of the band's new album, Home Counties. And I'll be reminiscing my trip to Tel Aviv with the city's very own pop star, Noga Erez, who kindly took me out dancing. That's all ahead on Culture. Do stay tuned. First for a bit of self-improvement. We thought learning a new skill would improve your quality of life, so we went to learn to paint at the Newlyn Art School in Cornwall. So many people find the restorative and creative power of painting is the most satisfying thing they've ever done. So I packed my easel and brushes, caught the 7 o'clock train from Paddington to Penzance, that route itself an advert for the painterly beauty of southwest England, and booked myself into the school, where I first spoke to Faye Dobinson, an artist and tutor who, that day, was teaching a life drawing class.
Starting people off in terms of life drawing, it always feels like a calling. They kind of arrive often a bit nervous, but knowing that they are there, they want to do it, they're ready to kind of bed in. The wonderful thing about Newlyn is each tutor has a very unique approach. It's definitely made the most of the way you yourself work is what you bring to the session. So I tend to work, if I say explosively initially, it's what I tend to do is find some exercises that really loosen them up and take away any fear they may have, any attachment to the outcome, to the drawing that they're making. And I would concentrate freeing them up like that and then spending the rest of the day, session, days, which however it works, honing in and really improving their ability to see objectively, because that's what it's all about.
And some of the other tutors have said, who are all working artists, have said that actually once you've tried to explain your practice or drawn out something from one of your students, it helps you. You go back into your studio and you think about what you said. You don't just say things to make a space in the room or to avoid an awkward silence. You take quite a lot of back of what you've said back into your own practice. That work for you?
Oh, absolutely. I love that. I mean, that's the wonderful thing. I'm very heart on sleeve anyway. So there's a certain honesty. There is an honesty with everything I relate. And I think also the vulnerabilities of being an artist, the vulnerabilities of making work, putting yourself out there, committing yourself in terms of visually making marks and doing drawings that then other people are going to see. That can all be terrifying. So there is a certain, yeah, there's a lovely give and take with the students. What you realise is, and I know for fact, every other tutor here feels the same as me. You absolutely see yourself all on one level. It's very odd to use the term students. You don't think, oh, I'll teach you this, or, you know, I deign to teach you this. It is very much you are helping other artists. And I think showing your vulnerability in that way is fantastic strength.
And it'd be nice to know a little bit about Newlyn. How local are you and how often do you teach here? Because you and the rest of the tutors are all professional artists, some of you based here, between here and other places. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about that, Faye.
It's a different vibe down here. It's all very real, very sweet, very supportive and really interesting. Anyone who's moved here has made a commitment to live on the edges of things, I think. So I live very much between London, my family and friends. Obviously, I have friends here too, lots of very good friends, lots of good connections as well. But I also have a lot of family and friends in London, so I tend to live between the two, but spend most of my time here. And it's worked brilliantly. It's interesting, I was discussing this with a studio mate from Trewydden, and he's now moving out because he's got a studio at home, and he said his fear is he hasn't got to go to work. And I've had both, funny enough. When I was in London, I've had one at home. I also had one in Christ Hackney that I used to go to, and then back at home again. Each have their charms. But for me, it is, number one, I get off the train even from London, and I get off and it's home, which is interesting, because I'm very proud of being a Londoner. It feels like home here. There is a physical shugging off of whatever it was, or the London, the energy, all that stuff. And then going to work is just, I'm eliminating other things at the moment. Did you find you have a career portfolio when you're an artist? So, like I said, I do weddings, I do a bit of care work, I do all sorts of things. But I'm really eliminating lots of extraneous stuff at the moment, and the feeling of going to work is just extraordinary. Yeah. I'm really happy, which is just extraordinary.
I think it's a rare thing. It's a great advert for it.
And just finally, just to bring it back to the teaching, because you've got such a lot of energy in that room, and you know, as you say, drawing people out of themselves a little bit is something that's necessary for you to do as the teacher there as well. And I know that you've been with these guys for 3 years. This is the last. Yeah. This is the last actually 3 days that they've asked to have added on to their course, which is wonderful. But do you get a little nervous before you have to walk into that room as well? Because you have to. Art, it's often your head, you know, you're not a performer, you're an artist. Does that, you know, to be honest, is there a little bit of you that has to take a deep breath before you walk into that room and be the teacher, as it were?
Absolutely. I absolutely team talk out loud. This morning I was driving to, I've now realised, so I used to get very, very anxious, and it used to be quite debilitating and tiring. And what I've learnt is, through various means, is that actually anxiety is a feeling, and it's actually quite evolutionary. It helps you, you know, the adrenaline flows, it helps you problem solve, it gets you somewhere. What I've realised now is, though, now I can manage that far, far better. I still have to remind myself, I have to say, like on the van this morning coming down the hill, I was going, Faye, you're a really great teacher, they really enjoy your lessons, like someone else was talking. Okay. I of course get very nervous, and I think that is shows respect towards what you're doing, and I think it shows respect towards the students and respect towards the quality in which you want to deliver something. I think if I was over casual, it would lack fire, or I don't feel it. I funnily enough, I draw people out, and thank goodness, I seem to do it quite naturally, seem to make people feel comfortable. And that's probably because I wear my heart on my sleeve. That's it.
That was Faye Dobinson, a tutor at the Newlyn Art School and a fine artist herself. And after a couple of days of oils, acrylics and a trip to the Scilly Isles to get some moody beach and landscapes, under the Newlyn Art School's tutelage, I returned to dry land and the old school building to see the main man, the founder of the Newlyn Art School, Henry Garfitt.
We've been looking for about 2 years for the right premises, and I can't tell you how many different fishnet lofts and different places I went to in Newlyn to try and find the right place, but this was absolutely perfect for it. It's got a great atmosphere. You can really feel that a lot's happened here since 1878 when it was built, but it's just perfect for the purpose.
It's one of those funny things, for people of a certain age walking into here, some of your students are and members of staff and all the rest of it, you feel a bit like you're going to school. Is that something you kind of wanted to keep, or you kind of go, oh well, it's a bit of luck, I suppose, that we've got this sturdy building? Does it make people kind of stop running in the corridors and tuck their shirts in a way, or are you kind of trying to encourage the opposite at the school?
I think we're trying to encourage the opposite, actually. Definitely, I don't feel like a headmaster quite, I'd say. I think we encourage people to make a mess. Like we were saying earlier, we're often trying to repaint the ceiling because there's paint splattered everywhere, and whether it's a school coming here or what we do most of the time, which is adults doing short courses and longer courses, they're getting a chance to work really big on the floor, throwing paint around, working with brushes on the end of big sticks, all sorts of things that help people free up and not feel precious about what they're doing. So, yeah, actually, it's quite a liberating place, really.
And as you say, you do short courses here, you do long courses, people come. There's a lot, presumably people buy this for people for a gift. It's a lovely place to be in the world. It's a great absorbing thing to do for a few days, maybe away from the hustle and bustle of people's everyday lives. But also there is a lot of practical mentoring of people that are artists, maybe in a middle part of their career or their practice somehow. How do you, and is it possible to teach people the job of being an artist, to walking into the studio and kind of cracking their knuckles and getting started? Because that's something that I'm interested in. And how do you and your tutors here teach that sort of thing?
I think that that's a thing that's particular to this school in a way, is that so much of it's based around artists sharing their practice and the things that they've learned in their own studios over decades potentially, rather than things that they've picked up at art school when they were at art school. We don't find that those sorts of conversations come up. It's much more about the combination of materials or the artists that they've been looking at or things that they've learned in their own time. All of that experience is there to be tapped into over 3 days on a short course or the weekends when people come for a year for this mentoring. And that's true of the professional development as well. There's so much that you have to learn to be an artist. You've got to be able to get yourself out there. You've got to be quite businesslike, really. And you've got to be as good at that as you are at being an artist, actually, in your work. And these artists are very generously sharing their kind of knowledge of the industry and the knockbacks and the highs and the lows. And that's gold dust, really.
There's a lot of nitty-gritty, isn't there? There's a lot of going to work. about being an artist. And I was intrigued and kind of heartened to see that that was very much all the artists that have studios here that teach the students here have said that, you know, they invite the students into their studios to say, this is kind of what it's like, without being big-headed. This is the kind of thing that you need to be arriving whenever you want to arrive, but you need to come here once a day. And it doesn't matter what thoughts you have, you can't, but you just need to have them in this space. It seems very basic, but I suppose that's one of the building blocks of anyone that wants to go on and be a full-time artist, right?
Yeah. There is something beautiful and palpable about an artist's space, actually, whether it's the smell or the look of what's around, the mess, the sofa where they think about stuff, all that stuff. But beyond that, I think it's almost surprising to people that they can come through, spend 3 days with us here, let's say, on a course, and get to be with really top artists who are basically just normal people. They're just talented and have dedicated their lives to doing one thing in particular. But going into their spaces and hearing them talk about the day-to-day of how their process is, their walk into the studio, as we found this morning, and all these different elements, they're really helpful things to hear, actually, because anyone can do it, actually. You've just got to really want to and give it the time. As art schools are quite a different entity from what they used to be, it's harder to get artists coming in for a very short spell, sharing what they do and then moving on. And that real experience of having students with artists is a really important thing. But it's much harder to come by, actually, in art schools today. And I think with the funding that's required to just get somebody through art school, through any college education, if you've got the prospect of not earning money necessarily from the degree that you get, people are less likely to do creative degrees, and it's all kind of coming in on itself at the moment. And I think there'll be more and more schools like ours, actually. I think people finding another way of learning.
That was Henry Garfitt, founder of the Newlyn Art School. And if you're interested in a course, short and sweet, or a little longer, go to newlynartschool.co.uk. You'll also find recommendations on where to go to learn a language, to cook, to write, the works. That's all in the culture section of Monocle's July-August issue. Now time for some music, and we're sticking very much in Britain as we meet our next guest. Last month, Saint-Étienne released a brand new LP. They're the 90s synth-pop band you all know and love, behind hits such as Only Love Can Break Your Heart and Nothing Can Stop Us. Back in the 90s, the band sung about London a lot, but their new record takes them out of the city and into the home counties that they hail from. The home counties are the suburban places that surround London, from Hertfordshire heading north to Sussex down south. In the latest issue, Monocle's Andrew Muller speaks to the band about their relationship with these places that are close in proximity to the capital, but about a million miles apart in other respects. Here he speaks with the lead singer, Sarah Cracknell.
I now live in Oxfordshire, which is kind of further out, but I still consider that to be home counties. And it's kind of like a dirty word, a bit. everyone thinks it's full of sort of Tories and commuter belt kind of...
Stockbrokers and fox hunters.
Yes, exactly that. But we grew up there, Bob, Pete and myself. So there's a kind of slight fondness in a way, given time, because we've had enough time. We've been away for a long time, you know, lived in London for years. And then you can sort of look back and take the good bits.
But you and Pete and Bob grew up in different home counties, but do they share one particular character? Is there a home counties mindset? Because they are quite different and quite geographically disparate places.
Yeah, they are. Is there a kind of mindset? There is a type of person, I suppose. And there's a kind of visually, there's in each sort of the home counties, sort of, there's a bit rural, and then there's a little, you know, sort of town centre and a bit of village life. And, you know, so a lot of the town centres, certainly when I was growing up, like the town centres near me when I was growing up in Berkshire, probably looked an exact replica of the town centres that were near Bob and Pete when they were growing up.
It is a place that a lot of people, especially when they're young, escape from. They're drawn into London, as you and Pete and Bob were. Was it a conscious decision all these years later to decide that we are returning to our roots, we are going to make an album about where we came from, or did it just happen organically?
It happened very organically. It really did. I'd done a couple of songs, one of which was alluding to sort of Oxfordshire. It's a song called Dive, and it talks about there's a cutting in the hillside. And when I drive from London to where I live now in Oxfordshire, there's a big hill stroke mountain, and there's a big slice taken out of the middle of it. And as you drive through, the look of the place completely changes. It becomes really green and lush and rural. And so I wrote that song, and I think it just triggered something in the boys' minds. Boys. chaps. Bob had seen a book in some junk shop or something called Home Counties. And it just, I don't know, it just came to him. And it was really handy having a theme for an album. It makes it much easier to write lyrics and stuff, because otherwise you're sort of clutching at thin air trying to think of a new topic to write about, you know, and having written songs for so long, you run out of ideas.
Did you find it gave the three of you a kind of discipline?
Yeah. And it suits us, that kind of discipline. We like it, you know. And we tend to write songs, you know, we write songs together, or someone will go and start one and the rest of us will help finish it off, or someone will write the whole of a lyric for a song. And, you know, so it varies. But we're very, I suppose, because we've been together for so long, we're quite in tune.
On this album then, when writing about the home counties, did you, or I guess the three of you, end up surprising yourself with what you wrote about them? Because it is a part of the world, as we were discussing, which is quite often mocked, derided, patronised, etc. Often most notably by people who came from there and couldn't
because they're embarrassed.
Exactly, and couldn't wait to get away. Did you end up, I guess, regarding it with more affection than you imagined you might?
Yeah, definitely. As you say, I couldn't wait to get out of Windsor. You know, I was desperate. I moved up to London when I was 17. You know, I was gone. Yeah, with time and with distance, you can sort of fall back in love with it a little bit, you know.
And were the three of you self-conscious about getting it right, as it were? Because there has, it's one of the things I think has been a real strength of St. Etienne's albums. There is a real sense of place about them, and mostly that place has been London. You've always been identified, not least by yourselves, as a very London band. There's a lot of references to London people and London places. Was there any worry about maybe we don't quite speak the language anymore where the home counties are concerned?
We have done an awful lot of London stuff, you're right. We've also done a bit of America on Good Humour. There was a lot of references to America. I don't know. I think it's just there, isn't it? You know, it's still in you and you can still remember it. And I think you've grown up there, so in that case, you're allowed to comment on it and talk about it. You know, my mum still lives in the same house that I grew up in, so
no concern about angry letters to local newspapers.
No, well, we didn't say anything mean or nasty or anything, did we? It's all pretty good.
That was Sarah Cracknell, lead singer of St. Etienne, and you can read about them in Monocle and make sure you listen to their live performance on Sessions at Midori House, which you can catch up with at monocle.com/radio. And their new album, Home Counties, is out now. We'll end by dancing into the night in Tel Aviv. Nothing says good quality of life like a city where people are dancing in the queue for their morning coffee. Well, maybe it was their morning after coffee, because after all, Tel Aviv is that sort of place and it was that sort of story. I went to answer the question, is Tel Aviv a good place to go dancing? And to do that, I enlisted the help of a wonderful Israeli pop singer and a mean dancer, it has to be said. Her name is Noga Erez, and we saw some of the club life that influenced her very fine new album, Off the Radar, in Tel Aviv. But we also went to all sorts of slightly cheesy establishments to have some good old late night fun. And I found out, and this is no spoiler, that Tel Aviv is indeed a good place to go dancing.
Can you dance while you shoot? Can you dance while you shoot? Can you shoot while dancing? Can you move while shoot? Shoot, 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 shoot.
Now, we came out and we went dancing in Tel Aviv. This was a story which when I originally sort of pitched it to the other editors of the magazine, it was simply called Tel Aviv is a good place to go dancing. And by hook and by crook, we ended up going and having an amusing night out. how much of your album is a kind of slice of cake cut out from Tel Aviv's music scene? To me, it seems something that could be, is amazingly international in its sound, but is there something that is definitively Tel Avivian about it as well, in terms of the scene that it illustrates, perhaps?
I have to tell you that when we went out dancing and we did our little club tour, it was probably the first time that I was going, you know, clubbing in I don't know how many years. I'm not a very big, you know, nightlife kind of person. And I consume the music that I consume at home because I like to really kind of listen to it. Even though I love dancing, I like dancing at home. I do that.
Me too.
Yeah. And I feel that it's a parallel process, you know, two different things. One is the fact that you can't really avoid the place that you live in. It gets inside in different ways. But at the same time, I feel like the culture that I represent is not the Tel Aviv culture, because I'm exposed to culture from all over the world. And I listen to music from everywhere. So it's a combination between the things. And if someone would ask me, so how did Tel Aviv influence you? I wouldn't say that the nightlife in Tel Aviv influenced me. That would not be the first thing. I would say that, you know, it's a very diverse place. It has so many cultures coming into one place. That would be the main influence of that place to me.
But some of those places we went to, Alphabet and Kuli Alma and Breakfast Club. Why did we go there twice?
Because we were too lazy to go to a further away place, but we were still very, very energized. So
okay, so we had to go. Yeah, we had to fight our way back in.
Yeah,
okay.
You're asking because you can't remember, right?
I'm just trying to piece this together for the story that's going to appear in the magazine. This is, you know, this is in-depth research, trying to sort of put things together again. Mm-hmm. And those places, you said, you know, this isn't kind of like your natural habitat now. How much did they change? Was it nice to go back and see some of these places? In terms of the music as well, is there anything that, do you learn anything as a musician coming and seeing these things? Maybe even just how people react to things or react to DJs.
You get really good music in clubs in Tel Aviv. And you walk, I mean, we walked a radius of, I don't know how many meters. It was maybe between 5 to 10 minutes walk from each club. And you get a whole different atmosphere. So I think that when we talk about music and music for dancing specifically, I think that DJs in Israel and clubs in Tel Aviv really understand kind of the dance floor and how to make people move and feel excited. And
it's quite reactive, right? I mean, that's the job of a DJ. You can't just go, this is my set, this is how it's going to be. But it seemed quite collegiate. There wasn't a wall, really. There wasn't a fourth wall between the DJ and the crowd.
No. And usually they can't afford a wall.
maybe they'd love
just
to have
one. Just put them in the middle.
Put them in the middle. But it's one of those funny things. As I say, we wanted to tell a story that was a cross-section of how the whole city works in short time. We had 3 days to do it. And the night we went out, we heard the best music. But then there's something kind of seemingly in the genes of Tel Aviv. Maybe it's an Israeli thing of people doing swing dancing down by the beach in the morning and stuff like this. This is kind of like, you know, elsewhere they'd be doing Tai Chi. In Israel, they're dancing. Is there anything you contribute that to? Or is that just, were we just lucky to see kind of old timers kind of grooving about as well as kind of going to clubs and seeing, you know, 20-somethings and teenagers?
Honestly, I've never seen people swinging on the beach.
I'll show you the pictures.
Honestly.
It's pretty good stuff.
So you'll have to prove it. If you have proof, I would believe you. I'm not very aware of that part. But I think that, I don't know, there's a kind of atmosphere of just living life in a very extreme way, feeling very alive. You know, people search for that thing in Tel Aviv or maybe in Israel. They want to feel alive. They want to feel like something is really taking up the time that they are here in the world.
There is a crackle to it.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed that. It was my first time there. I noticed there was a crackle to it, which is a good thing, I think.
The radar.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. You can read all the stories that you've heard about in today's programme in the July-August issue of Monocle magazine, which is out now. You've been listening to Culture, where my producer is, of course, the holy mother of all dancing, Holly Fisher, and I've been Robert Bound. And to play us out, let's have a sneak preview of a live performance Noga Erez did for us here at the Monocle 24 Studios, which will be airing on the sessions at Midori House in a couple of weeks. This is Noga performing Noisy. Thanks for tuning in.
Oh.